We've been going through the book of Acts, dealing with the great tumult and trauma of this move out of the old covenant into the new covenant. Last time we were talking a lot about circumcision, remember? I was reading a book that I mentioned in class, Bruce Molina. The name of that book was The New Testament World, Insights from Cultural Anthropology. He has a chapter entitled Kinship and Marriage. He doesn't discuss circumcision because he's focusing on the New Testament, and circumcision is really an Old Testament institution. But he says some things that are very interesting. He points out how different cultures have different approaches to marriage and family, to kinship structures. You can almost tell everything there is to know about a society by focusing in on how they view kinship bonds. All right? You'd be absolutely astonished beyond words to discover how much you can learn about a people by discovering how they view family relations and the obligations between family members. And who are family members? Are your fourth cousins considered family members? No. But in other cultures, they would be considered to be near kinsmen. So he points out how there are different approaches to marriage and to parenting and to fraternity or sibling relations. There is one, a couple distinctions I'll just make and then I want to move on. Exogamy and endogamy. Those who are exogamous, and we are as a culture, prohibit marriages within the kinship unit. Exogamy, or openness to outside groups, symbolizes universalism, he says, since it links various solidarity groups on a broader scale. This is the practice in the United States. But there's another form. It's called endogamy, prohibiting marriages outside the kinship group. This is called endogamy. Endogamy, closeness to outside groups, symbols particularism, since it results in a society of relatively small, closed segments. He says, on the one hand, as a matter of fact, our own kinship system in the U.S. still eludes complete systematic analysis. Our culture is in virtual chaos because we're competing and warring over five or six different value systems. Feminism, traditionalism, Christianity. There are all kinds of value systems at war in our society, so it's almost impossible to see any clear consensus or unanimous arrangement or pattern that everybody agrees on in family life. Our culture's a melting pot. That's why it's so unusual in that regard. But he says that the ancient Mediterranean culture tended to be very endogamous. That is, you tried to marry within the kinship group, and if you married outside of it, you tried to bring the people you were marrying into the kinship group. He says that family and marriage norms, or kinship norms, are like the hidden mass of an iceberg supporting the tiny visible tip that is manifest in questions such as, you know, who are you allowed to marry? Who are you not allowed to marry? What do you do with your spouse when you marry him? Are they part of your family? Are you part of their family? Do you set up a separate family? And this sort of thing. He says, not only is the Mediterranean world of antiquity endogamous, it's also patrilineal. That is, fathers raise daughters with the hope of keeping them in the family so they don't end up expending all that money and energy on somebody else's gain, on some other kinship group. So the descent system is patrilineal. Whenever you have polygamy in cultures, you have vastly different configurations. In fact, he points out something that's very interesting. Let me find the exact quote here. He says this. Brother and sister share the most intense cross-sexual relationship in this sort of cultural arrangement where you have polygamy. So much so that the brother readily gets highly incensed when an unauthorized male approaches either his wife or his sister. When Pharaoh wanted to see Sarah, Abraham said, I'm her brother, she's my sister. We think, what a scoundrel, what a fink. But what's actually going on there is in polygamous cultures where a man's got several wives, he can't keep track of all his kids. So you don't look to your father, and a woman doesn't necessarily look to her husband for protection. You look to your brothers if you're a girl, and you look to your sons if you're a mother. Because your husband might be favoring other wives besides you. Doesn't that almost hurt to try to think that way? Isn't it weird, huh? kind of like turning your socks inside out and putting them on as a shirt or something, you know? How do you go about reconfiguring society that way? Do you realize that apart from Christianity, there is no civilization in history that required strict monogamy? We are the weirdos in history. That is the norm. We're the exception. So when we read the Old Testament, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg. The mass that we don't see are all of the obligations and expectations that go unspoken. Because most communication within a culture is subliminal. I'd like to invite you all over my house for turkey dinner this November. Most of what is being said is being not stated. It's going unstated. Thanksgiving. The pilgrims and all of that. When people share traditions, they can say a lot in a little. The tip of the iceberg can hide a mass of meaning. And that's what's going on in the New Testament. And that's what's going on with circumcision. And when Paul goes around telling Gentiles they don't need to be circumcised, he's basically going around pulling the plug on the culture known as Judaism. Because the Jews depend upon circumcision in two ways. One, it actually restricts the amount of men who are going to be coming into Judaism. Why do you want to restrict the number of men? Because men are usually competitors. But it's not going to restrict the number of women. And women converts to Judaism always outnumbered greatly male converts in antiquity. Figure it out. I mean, women don't have to get circumcised. Men do. The lines form on my right and left. One will be very long, one will be very short. Why? Because women will bring wealth into your family line. If you can get women who've been raised outside of your own culture, and they get the dowry, and they get all the training and education you don't have to pay for, then you get a maximum of benefits with a minimum of expense. Jewesses throughout history have greatly influenced the fortunes of world Judaism. Bernice, in the book of Acts, if you read carefully. Nero himself had a mistress, a Jewish mistress, who constantly looked out for the fortunes and the needs of the Jewish community in Rome. This isn't just Judaism. This is all endogamous patrilineal cultures. When I talk to African students, or I talk to Asian students who come from tribal cultures, they kind of laugh at how uncomprehending Americans are to the hard facts of daily life as it's been for centuries and centuries. Our civilization is rather unique. By the way, I mentioned last time, did I not, that I would try to bring in a list of names of notable and influential Jews from that Jesus Connection, that book, The Jesus Connection. Listen to some of the notables here. Less than 2% of America, and also a very small minority in European culture. Ever heard of Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud, Karl Marx? In the Supreme Court, there's been a series. Felix Frankfurter, Louis Brandeis, Henry Kissinger, Barry Goldwater, Howard Metzenbaum. And then in the acting world, just there are all these pictures. I couldn't believe all of them. Cary Grant, Kirk Douglas, Paul Newman, James Caan, Lauren Bacall, Peter Sellers, Goldie Hawn, Diane Cannon, Dustin Hoffman, Madeline Caan, Barbara Streisand, Joan Collins, Danny Kaye, Edward G. Robinson, Tody Curtis, Rod Steiger, Ed Asner, William Shatner, and Leonard Nimoy. Henry Winkler, Lauren Green, Michael Landon, Tony Randall, Jack Klugman, Peter Falk, David Jansen, George Burns, Jack Benny, Hal Linden, Norman Lear, Werner Klemper, the one I mentioned, Colonel Klink, Ted Koppel, Barbara Walters, Mike Wallace, Howard Cosell, and then musicians, the list is, I won't read them all, Billy Joel, Bob Dylan, Barry Manilow, Paul Simon. It's a very long list. Anyway, they're a minority in our culture, but they have an incredible impact on nations where they live. And I would say mostly positive. But like any human being, they're also going to bring in negative elements. Gentiles have to fight the moral impediment, the weakness of resentment and envy. Because constantly you find in the family, the firstborn is envied. Not jealousy, but envy. Remember, we've made the distinction before, have we not, between jealousy and envy? We don't just simply want to emulate, we resent and try to tear down the firstborn. So anti-Semitism is almost written into the collective fabric of the human race because they have advantages and privileges that accrue to the firstborn. So it's something always to watch out for. All right. So in the book of Acts, we're moving out of the old into the new, out of particularism into universalism, out of a very worldly, earthly political system into a spiritual and heavenly sacramental order. This is what God was trying to get his people to recognize and implement now for centuries and centuries, going all the way back 1,500 years to Moses. But the Jews continually resisted the idea of being a kingdom of priests. They wanted to be a kingdom of soldiers, as we said. And so here we finally see a degree of success on the part of God institutionalizing a kingdom of priests, a priestly kingdom or a holy nation. We've looked at Acts 15, but I want to call your attention to one thing real quickly. Acts 15, verse 15. James, the bishop of Jerusalem, stands up and announces that I agree with Peter that we shouldn't have to circumcise these Gentile converts. And with this, he says, the words of the prophets agree, as it is written, after this I'll return, and I'll rebuild the dwelling of David which has fallen. I will rebuild its ruins, and I will set it up, so that the rest of men may seek the Lord. And all the Gentiles who were called by my name, says the Lord, who has made these things known from of old. Now, James says that this ancient prophecy from Amos is being fulfilled in his own lifetime, under the present circumstances. What is the dwelling of David, which has fallen and is in need of rebuilding? What is the dwelling of David? Is it the temple? The temple's still there. Or is it? Who's the one responsible for building the temple that's in Jerusalem? Herod. Herod, who's not even an Israelite, who's a fratricidal maniac. All right? So there's something inauspicious about that temple. But there's something even bigger than the dwelling of David. What is the dwelling of David? It's more than the temple. It's more than a palace. It's the house of David. And what does the house of David refer to? Rebecca? The lineage? The dynasty? The kingdom? In other words, the kingdom of David has fallen. Well, how can you prove that? Well, for the last 500 years, you've gone without a king. Even though 1,000 years before, when David was alive, God swore an oath to David saying, there will always be a descendant to sit upon the throne. But for 500 years, he seems to have forgotten the oath that he swore. Well, there was a descendant. He just couldn't come out into the public. Why? What would happen if he did? He'd get snuffed out by the Gentile overlords who were subjugating the Jews. So for 500 years, whoever was the Davidic heir had to eat a lot of humble pie and stay very private and quiet about it. Until Jesus. Jesus rebuilds the Davidic kingdom. The house of David, the dwelling of David, is rebuilt. And what is the dynastic kingdom of David rebuilt? What is it? What do we call it? The church, which is made up of Gentiles as well as Jews, and it's now distinctly different than what it used to be. It is not primarily earthly, political, and military. It's heavenly, it's spiritual, and sacramental. And so circumcision is no longer a kind of endogamous restriction to consolidate political power. Now, baptism does what? Peter declared what baptism does in verse 9. God makes no distinction between us and them, between Jews and Gentiles any longer, but he cleansed their hearts by faith. So through faith and baptism, Gentiles are cleansed in a way that the Jews were never cleansed in the Old Testament under circumcision. So now, the kingdom of God is being completed and fulfilled much more successfully and earnestly than before. All right. And from here on, Luke focuses exclusively on Paul. Why? Because Peter's work is done. Peter, as prime minister, has handed on the baton, as it were, to the real apostle to the Gentiles. Peter was the one who opened the door to the Gentiles by admitting Cornelius to baptism and the full membership and inclusion in the church, which is now seen as the kingdom of David. But Peter's a Galilean fisherman. He's not going to be so successful going around converting Gentiles en masse and convincing his fellow Jews that what's happening is in line with the Old Testament, with the Hebrew Bible. Paul, on the other hand, is going to be an unstoppable force, because no Jew in his lifetime and in the society around Paul, no one's going to be able to withstand his reasoning. He's the best student of the best rabbi in Jewish history. And he's going to be able to stop mouths and say, look, what's happening with Gentiles coming in is truly a fulfillment of the Old Covenant. Don't tell me it's not. Don't tell me I'm misinterpreting the Old Testament. I'm a more accomplished scholar than you are. He's not just rebutting their arguments, though. He's actually being sent out to the Gentiles. In a certain sense, Paul tells us in the book of Romans how he perceives his own ministry and God's design for it. All right, it's sort of like this. You know, if Paul was such a preeminent student or great pupil of Gamaliel, why not? You know, if I was God's counselor, I'd say, God, come over here. With all due respect and reverence, I've got some advice to you. Don't throw your pearls before swine. Those Gentiles out there aren't going to understand his sophisticated scriptural exegesis. They're not going to be able to follow the line of argumentation. He's been trained by the best rabbis. Send them to other people who've been trained by those rabbis, and he'll convince the Jews that this plan to include the Gentiles is a faithful interpretation of the prophecies in the Hebrew Bible. That's my advice, God. Doesn't it seem reasonable? But the problem is not intellectual. It isn't as though the Jews are just kind of thinking there, boy, you know, if only we had a really accomplished scholar who could open up for us the prophecies in a more convincing way. Sin is never an intellectual problem. It's a moral problem. It's rooted in pride and selfishness. So how do you deal with somebody who doesn't understand the truth because he doesn't want to, and he doesn't want to because he doesn't like the implications of that truth? You can't deal with him directly. So how can you deal with him? I see it all around me in the church today. I see liberal Catholics by the thousands who think the Pope is cracked, who think that Father McBrien at Notre Dame is far more Catholic, even though he doesn't believe that the devil exists, that there are demons or angels, or most of the miracles in the New Testament actually happened. They say, well, he's so with it. He's just so up to date. He's so contemporary and American. I can really prefer my Catholicism coming from him. So he's on all the talk shows. He's being interviewed by the paper all the time. Or Dan McGuire, the professor of moral theology at Marquette, is always being interviewed for his comments on whatever John Paul says. Here's a professor who endorses abortion or just divorced his wife, an ex-nun who married him, an ex-priest. You know, and I go around and I don't know. I can answer fundamentalists because I know the Bible well enough. But when it comes to liberal Catholics, man, it's like I've got both hands tied behind my back. How do you get through to them? Sometimes I feel like I've got more in common with Bible Christians than with liberal Catholics who don't want the Pope, don't want Mary, don't really believe that Christ is present in the Eucharist, and so on. What do you do with people like that? I don't know how to deal with them directly. So what I'm going to do to them is what I think Paul was doing to the Jews in his day. Paul's going to go out to the Gentiles. And as he says in Romans 9 and 10, I'm going to make them jealous. Turn with me to the book of Romans real quickly, and you can just see how Paul understands his own ministry. In Romans 9, he shows God's plan. Verse 25, just as he says to Hosea, in Hosea, those who were not my people, I will call my people. And her who was not my beloved, who was not beloved, I will call my beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called sons of the living God. And Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. For the Lord will execute his sentence upon the earth with rigor and dispatch. And as Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts had not left us children, we would have fared like Sodom and been made like Gomorrah. What shall we say then? The Gentiles who do not pursue righteousness have attained it, that is, the righteousness through faith, but that Israel, who pursued the righteousness which is based on law, did not succeed in fulfilling the law. Look at chapter 10, verse 1 now. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but it is not enlightened. For being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they didn't submit to God's righteousness. You'll see many people today who are really zealous for the poor and are zealous for peace and justice while they're contracepting, while they're endorsing abortion, while they're ignoring the holiness requisite for the Eucharist, and so on. How do you deal with that? They're establishing their own righteousness, a kind of external, visible self-righteousness. And I also know traditionalists on the other side of the coin as well. But his point Well, it's elusive, but let's follow along and see exactly how he understands his ministry here. Look at chapter 11 real quickly. Leading up to chapter 11, you can see in chapter 10, verse 17, so faith comes from what is heard, and what is heard comes by the preaching of Christ. But I ask you, have they not heard? Indeed they have, for their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. And again I ask, did Israel not understand? First Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation I will make you angry. That's what Moses declared back in Deuteronomy 32. Then Isaiah is so bold to say, I have been found by those who didn't seek me, and I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. But if Israel, he says, all day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. Has God rejected his people, I ask? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God hasn't rejected his people whom he foreknew. So what's the purpose of Paul's ministry? Verse 13. Now I am speaking to you Gentiles. Inasmuch then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. He's deliberately trying to stir up fire, the flame of jealousy among the Jews. Can you see elsewhere where he goes on and says the same thing? Paul sees himself as the apostle to the Gentiles, and he magnifies his ministry to the Gentiles because that's the only way he can influence his fellow Jews to convert. He can't deal with them directly. Whenever he tries, they go crazy. They rush him. They stone him. They take oaths never to eat again until they've killed him, like we read about in the book of Acts. Well, you can't go and say, come on, guys, settle down. Let's just roll up our sleeves and debate Scripture. Let me show you from the prophets that Gentiles now are equal members of God's family. You'll find pieces of Paul all over the street if he tries that. So, God says to me and other people who would advise him contrarily, he'd say, no, you can't send Paul to these people to argue with them. They're not going to hear him. They have set their course. Their problem is no longer intellectual. It's moral. They're selfish, they're proud, and they're set. So what are you going to do? Well, they think they've got a monopoly on God's blessing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send you out to the Gentiles. I'm going to send their best to the worst. Their best pupil of their best rabbi isn't going to be teaching them. He's going to be teaching those that they consider to be the worst, the scum, the offscouring. They're going to look and they're going to say, what is Gamaliel's pupil doing going to the goyim to teach these defiled swine? And what is he teaching them? Oh, that they are the recipients of the promises of Abraham just as much as we are, if not more, because they accept the Messiah. We have a monopoly on blessings. Then all of a sudden they look and they discover that all these people are celebrating all of these divine institutions, are experiencing all kinds of God's blessings, healings and miracles and tongues, and they're studying our Bible. And they're saying, we are the recipients of all of these prophesied blessings. And the Jews are going to be saying, no, they're not. No, they're not. Who do they think they are? And they're going to say, what's going on here? What is God doing healing and teaching and blessing them? Meanwhile, we're in exile. We're captivity. The Romans are our overlords. Why has God forsaken us? Why has God forsaken us? I think something analogous is going on in the church today. Because there are so many people out there who want God more than the people inside the Catholic Church. And what's God doing? He's blessing evangelical and charismatic ministries 100 times more than certain parishes. And these Catholics are losing their kids, they're losing their spouses to fundamentalist churches and so on. They're saying, what's wrong? You know, what's wrong? Well, then God is stirring up a very proud, foolish, and selfish people with jealousy by blessing outsiders more than insiders. I think he's going to bless the outsiders so that they will recognize the church as their family, come in and renew it, and a lot of people who think of themselves as insiders are going to wake up one morning and discover that they're outsiders, that they haven't really been listening to Christ speaking to the Pope. They haven't been recognizing Christ's presence in the Eucharist. That's what we need to do to understand the existential drama of this New Testament of ours. We can see ourselves in the same salvation history. It's still going on. We don't understand what's going on around us because we don't understand the New Testament in terms of what was going on back then. In other words, I'm an apostle to you Gentiles. Why? Because I love you so much? No. Because I love my Jews so much. In fact, he says in Romans 9, he said this, I have such great sorrow and unceasing anguish of heart, I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, my race. So I'm willing to go to hell to get them back to Christ. Whoa. That's like Moses at Mount Sinai saying, they worship the golden calf and you're angry? I understand. Blot me out instead. Blot my name out of your book of life. Paul's like a new Moses here. God says to Moses, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to use you to get them back to me the long, hard way. God's saying the same thing to Paul right now. Paul is not saying, Gentiles, I don't really love you. I use you to get you to stir up the jealousy of the Jews. It isn't a lack of love, but it's a love which focuses upon the neediest of those around him, which he sees are the Jews. Now, what does this mean? I think it means, I'll use my own family. All right, Michael is the firstborn, and I've got Gabriel, Hannah, and Jeremiah. And sometimes Michael, you know, Saturday, I went up to give a talk up in Stowe near Akron, and Michael was going to go because I wanted to help him just, you know, just to discover what I'm doing when I teach. And he was really excited. And Gabriel said, can I go too? Can I go too? Michael said, no, I'm the firstborn. See, my theology is having its effect in my family, you know. Actually, if I never said a word, that's what happens, you know. He says, Gabriel, you're 7, I'm 9. So he's a financial wizard now at the age of 9. And he says, Gabriel, you know, we're going to be selling books, we're going to be talking to people, we're going to be, you know, passing out sheets of paper, you know, doing various things. And I said, well, Michael, don't you think, though, that you could show him what to do so that he's not going to do it like you are, but he could watch you? And he goes, no, he's not ready. I have half a mind to say, Gabriel, you go. Michael, you stay. All right? But Michael's pride is not such that it's reached that point. I said, Michael, I'm going to have Gabriel going. And he was really indignant. He couldn't understand why Gabriel was allowed to go. When I was 7, I didn't go. Oh, we weren't doing anything like this then, you know. But still, I mean, you said I could go. It was really hard, you know. So I just kind of thought, well, okay, I'll tell you what. You be the master and he'll be the apprentice. All right? And we ended up taking one of the students who lives with us as well. And he'll show you what to do, and you show Gabriel what to do. Well, that arrangement worked, but just barely. Just barely. It's the type of thing, though, in the past, what I've had to do when I see a firstborn son thinking of himself as so privileged that he should have a kind of monopoly on whatever advantages are to be doled out, what I'll say is, okay, there's one episode I don't want to recount. It wasn't pretty. I wouldn't want to associate anybody with it. But sometimes a parent has to say, look, if that's the way you're going to be, you're not going to get anything, and you're going to see your younger kids get everything. So you learn to acquire a heart for them. My son Michael is one of the finest firstborns I know, but he's still a son of Adam. And he needs to be baptized, and he'll need to be confirmed. You know, he's my kid, so the poor kid needs help, you know, and grace. But the Jews, as God's firstborn, have succumbed to the natural temptation of the firstborn. They don't see themselves as the role model and the servant of those who are less than them. They see themselves as kind of having a privileged monopoly. So how does a father get through? He starts blessing the younger. All right? What's the classic parable about this? The prodigal son. The purpose of the prodigal son parable is not to show the father's love for the prodigal son. Did you catch this when you read through Luke? Turn back to Luke and see this. Everybody tends to focus on what is secondary. I mean, God, the Father's love for the prodigal son is significant. Don't get me wrong. But in Luke 15, 11 through 32, the primary point of that parable can only be discerned by backing up and reading the context. What is the context? Look at Luke 15, verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him, and the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, this man receives sinners and even eats with them. So he told them this parable. A man's got 100 sheep. He loses one, he leaves the 99 and finds them. A woman's got 10 silver coins. She loses one, she leaves the 9 and she goes and finds it. A man's got 2 sons.
and he loses one, and then he finds them.
What is the purpose of the parable? To focus upon the joy at finding one coin, one sheep, or one son? No. To say, if that's the way you would be with a coin, and that's the way you'd be with a sheep, why wouldn't you be that way with your brother? Who's lost and now found, who is dead and he's now alive. These tax collectors and all of these sinners are eating with the Messiah. You should be rejoicing and not resenting. The purpose of the prodigal son parable, the primary purpose, is to put a spotlight on the envy, the resentment of the Pharisees. They're like the elder brother who says, no, I'm not going to go to that party. His elder brother was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what this meant. And he said, your brother is come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he's received him safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, lo, these many years I have served you. And the word there for serve is that of a slave. In other words, for all these years I've been a slave to you. And I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But when this son of yours, not when my brother, but this son of yours came, who has devoured your living with harlots, you killed for him the fatted calf. What is that older brother saying? You unrighteous father, you have no moral standards. We have a family law that I live by. And I didn't realize that you could lapse from it so easily, Dad. When your son, the one who squandered your wealth with whores, comes home, and you squander even more of that wealth on him. What is this righteousness of the elder brother? It's a pretense. It isn't real righteousness. He's zealous for righteousness as a thin disguise for his own greed and his own bad relationship with his father. He doesn't see his father as a father. He sees him as a taskmaster. He didn't see himself as a son. He sees himself as a slave. I know so many Catholics who do everything just right, punctiliously, all the devotions and all the liturgical, and they get really upset when a priest just departs a little bit from the liturgy, because after all, and they don't realize, hey, look, that priest may have been influenced by some very flaky theologians, and the fact that he's doing it that decently is almost a miracle. Let's love him back to even greater wholeness. No, Wait a second, we're a family. They're brothers and sisters, and sometimes fathers and mothers out there. We should be dying to get them home. And when they come close, we shouldn't say, well, you still diverge from liturgical norms some. You're not good. That's Phariseeism. Sure, I want liturgical precision down to the smallest red in the rubrics. But if I don't get it, I'm not going to major on the minors. That's what the elder brother was doing. He's saying, look at all the things that he's done wrong. Yeah, but he's home. He's home. The younger brother does not come home and say, oh, gosh, I missed you, Dad, so much. He came home, why? Because he was hungry. You talk about unworthy motives? Most of us would have done what that older brother would have done. He would have said, hey, kid, why'd you come home? Because you missed me so much? Yeah, right. Because you just wanted to be with Dad? And you just loved the warm environment of the home where you grew up? No. Because I wasn't allowed to eat the pods that the pigs were eating. This message is for us today. And Paul saw it as for his own kinsmen then. Paul has a consuming passion of love for the Gentiles. He sees them as brothers and sisters. But the more immediate kinsmen are the ones that he's so concerned about that he's just burned up with love for them. So he's not just using the Gentiles as a means to an end. He's loving them and seeing them become his brothers and sisters. But those who are already his brothers and sisters are on the verge of excommunication or of running away from home. That elder brother. And the father said to him, son, you always were with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad, for this your brother was dead. Notice the father says, he's your brother. It's not my son, he's your brother. Everything that I have has been yours. And yet the Pharisees don't think that way. The Pharisees are thinking, we've been slaving away for centuries and centuries for a little bit of blessing. We've been faithful slaves. And now all of a sudden, what comes up? Let me read to you a clipping here. It was taken from an Associated Press article in the Cincinnati Inquirer in December 28, 1990. So so it's over a year old. Jerusalem. A leading rabbi has outraged Holocaust survivors and secular Israelis by claiming that the Nazi genocide was God's punishment for sins, such as violating the Jewish Sabbath and eating pork. Hundreds of Israelis called a radio talk show Thursday to let off steam about the remarks of Rabbi Eliezer Shock, 97, an ultra-Orthodox rabbinical sage who also happens to be the kingmaker of Israeli governments. Quote, "Not for a long time has any single remark caused such an emotional reaction," said Razi Barkai, the host of the Israeli talk show. He said that calls ran about 3-2 against the rabbi. Imagine that. Two people for every three were calling and saying, "I agree with the rabbi." 6 million of us were slaughtered because we were eating pork. At one level, Shock was simply repeating a theme common in the Bible, divine retribution against the Jewish people for straying from the path of the religious law. At another level, though, many took his remarks to mean that the Jews somehow were to blame for the Nazis' behavior. Quote, "The Almighty keeps a balanced sheet of the world, and when the sins become too many, he brings destruction," Shock told Jewish seminary students earlier this week. "The last time he brought destruction, it was the Holocaust." Menachem Rusak, a survivor of Auschwitz and a war crimes investigator, said Shock shamed and humiliated millions of Holocaust victims. Earlier this year, though, Shock, in effect, made Yitzhak Shamir prime minister by ordering his political supporters to join Shamir's coalition. End of story. So this rabbinical sage is telling people that 6 million Jews were slaughtered by God for what reason? Because they were working on Saturday and eating pepperoni pizzas and bacon for breakfast. What picture of God does that project? God's up there saying, "Don't you dare enjoy pepperoni pizzas or even sausage or pork roast, you know. And if you do, well, and if you're working on Saturday too, I'll slaughter 6 million of you. I'll have the Nazis descend and kill 6 million people, gas them, burn them." What kind of picture of God does that project? If you were God, how would you feel if a rabbi said, "Well, God ordained 6 million of us to be slaughtered because we were working on Saturday and eating pork"? Is that a father? Or is that a master? Contemporary Judaism institutionalizes the Pharisaic religion. They will assert that and defend it themselves. They're not basing their religion upon the Old Testament. They can't. Where's the temple? Where's the priesthood? Where's the sacrificial system? They're basing it upon the oral tradition that the elders received after the golden calf. Precisely that law which the apostles declare to have been dispensed, releasing Jews and Christians, as Peter said in Acts 15, a burden which neither we nor our fathers have been able to bear. In other words, this mindset is still with us, but not just in Judaism. I find it more common in Catholicism than anywhere else, where Catholics are going to the church with what I call ritual presumption. "I don't know God as Father. I don't pray except to recite all these prayers, which aren't very meaningful to me, but I want to get to heaven. You know how God is. I have to jump through all the right hoops and say all the right prayers and go through all the rituals, and then I get to heaven." It isn't a family affair where I'm passionately in love with my father and with my eldest brother who laid his life down so that I would not only become his sibling but his bride. It's a bunch of rote ritual to get into heaven. We reduce God's family plan down to servility the same way that elder brother does. And when you live that kind of legalism, what results? In the 40s and the 50s, legalism prevailed throughout many parts of the church. We were strong and vital, but we discovered that the inner core was rotten. How do you discover that? By having the 60s hit the church. After Vatican II, there's this attitude among dissenting theologians. Before Vatican II, there was this attitude. If the magisterium condemns a theologian, then what he's teaching is heresy. So what do you look for whenever you're studying a theologian? Has the Vatican condemned him or not? All right. Since Vatican II, what happens? Well, Hans Kung has not been condemned and excommunicated. So one archdiocese out on the West Coast trumpets him as the most influential Catholic theologian in the world and puts on a seminar for a whole weekend for the archdiocese. Why? Who are you to condemn him if the Pope hasn't? That's legalism. In other words, you shouldn't be looking to see whether the Vatican has condemned something or not to see if it's right or wrong. You should be looking into the scriptures, looking into what the popes have said is true. In other words, read the encyclicals, Vatican II documents, if you're looking for just simply, you know, well, is he condemned? That's minimalism. That's the way a lot of people look at dating, for instance, and what to do on dates. Well, how far is too far? Can we pet? Can we French kiss? What if her shirt is off? You know, well, once you're asking those questions, you know, you're a legalist. You're not pursuing holiness and purity. You're just seeing how much impurity you can take in without killing your soul. That's deadly. That's pretense. That's fraud. And it's all done in the name of obediential servitude, transforming God the Father, who wants you to be healthy and whole, into God the Master, who sets up these hoops that you have to jump through in order to get to heaven. Legalism in the 50s is the cause of the descent in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Because people keep waiting for the Pope to blow the whistle and play cosmic cop. Say, oh no, this guy's breaking the law, this guy's breaking the law. Instead of just reading the encyclicals and saying, wow, this is truth. This is to my mind what steak is to my mouth. I'm going to chew this and I'm going to get whole and strong. They say, well, let's listen. Did the Pope condemn him? No. And do those people read encyclicals and try to study and understand the truth? No. Legalism is the predominant mentality in almost all of us, in almost every age of the church. What we see among the Jews in the first century is what we see in the church in almost every age. And we have to fight in our own spiritual lives constantly. It isn't just old and new covenant in the first century. It's the struggle that we have in our interior life. We tend to think like slaves. God wants us to think like sons and daughters. We tend to think that the law represents like holy handcuffs to keep us from the things that feel good, when actually the law is what the Father gives us so we can grow up and blossom and become everything He made us to be. So our approach to confession is, well, is this a mortal sin? Oh, it isn't? Okay, then I don't have to go to confession. I can receive the Eucharist and, you know, and it's moral minimalism, which is just subtle legalism. We don't try to get all that the Father has for us. It's just a little bit. Paul recognizes what he was, a Pharisee. And he says, all the righteousness that I had back then can't compare to what I have in Christ. In Philippians 3 says, all the self-righteousness I had accumulated through my ritual obedience as a Pharisee is a pile of dung compared to what I have in Christ. In Christ, you've got sonship. Outside of Christ, you've got servility. You're a slave. You might be an obedient slave. You might be a proud slave, but you're not an heir. Slaves don't get an inheritance. They get a wage. That's moving from the old into the new. All right. Now, this is the message of Romans. This is the message of 1 and 2 Corinthians. This is the message of Galatians. Listen carefully for it. Train your ears so that they hear the word of a father, not just a sovereign master. In Galatians 4, I'm just going to read two verses and listen to this and see if you heard the first time what you hear now. I mean that the heir, so long as he's a child, that is an immature child, he's no better than a slave, although he's the owner of all the estate. So with us, when we were children in the old covenant, we were slaves. But when the time had fully come, God sent forth his son, born of woman, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive the full maturity of sonship. That we might receive, the term there, adoption, is misleading. The Greek word actually means the full rights of sons. It's like a 12-year-old doesn't inherit his father's estate until he's no longer a minor. When he reaches maturity, then he becomes a legal heir. I hope this, I feel like I'm not being very effective at getting this point across. And I don't know what it's going to take for me to make the primary message of the New Testament clear and understandable. I'll try to figure out some more ways, but you try to figure out some ways too, because I feel like I am only lecturing and telling you, and I feel like you're doing a minimum right now in terms of hard reading. And I want, in the worst way, for you guys to roll up your sleeves and take the one, you're going to have probably one crack at this in the 4 years you're here. One chance to really master the New Testament message better than you ever have before, and better than you probably will in the future. So come with the questions and really ask yourself, what's he saying? What's he saying? As you read through these epistles, don't just do assignments. Don't be morally minimalistic in the class either. Try to get all that we have, all that's there. We're out of time. See you later.